I've been reading several books by about Anandamayi Ma, the joy-permeated mother that Master describes in Autobiography of a Yogi. And she was known for a particular characteristic, Kayala, I think they called it. I don't know what the actual word is, but they only use the Sanskrit word or the Hindi word, which means because she had no ego, she had no personal will. So it wasn't like Ma wants to do this. So you couldn't say that about her. But she was continually and forcefully moved to take action, to do things in certain ways. So that's what they always called it. It was essentially the power of the infinite flowing through her. But she was especially known for the way she would travel, and she just traveled endlessly, especially in the early part of her life, and she would just decide to go. She would sometimes decide in the middle of the night that it was time to leave. And when she felt it was time to go, she would just get up and walk out of the ashram, and just with nothing in her hand, and no railway ticket or anything, just walk out. And there was a small group of people. The group got bigger as she advanced. I mean, she became better known, but there was always one or two, one woman in particular, Didi, she was called, sister. And when Ma was on the move, Didi would just pack up the little few things that she felt she needed, because she would feed her and take care of her, and they would literally just run down the road after her. And it's quite a story. And before she died in 1982, in her 80s, so she was moving around a lot before there was internet or cell phones or anything like that. And if a devotee went to India and wanted to see Ma, you had to find her. And you had to hope that she was where she was supposed to be by the time you got there. And there were a few people who were known. You could try to contact this one and they would know. And the few of the people who would travel with Ma would always try to keep somebody informed so they could be found. Sometimes Ma would make herself impossible to find. David actually went to India and actually met her on the basis of just being an Indian, wanting to see her and trying to find her. Overhearing some people talking about her, being led to this one and this one. I won't tell his story because it's a nice story. Ask him sometime. It's a very nice story. Ending up being taken in a horse-drawn cart by a man who didn't speak any English and just deposited at some tiny country house where she happened to be. The relevance of that is, and here's the other side of it, which is that her devotees, different of her devotees, because she would never assert her will, she would just, she would hint, or she would, it was not always obvious, and so people became more adept, some were more adept at interpreting her kayal, and knowing what it was that she was trying to do and really wanted. Those people were highly prized because they could feel it and they would be able to move with it. Now, the reason I bring that up is that the life of Christ, the modern examples of great spiritual souls help us to understand the ancient examples, because the ancient examples get so overlaid with myth and really misplaced devotion that wants to remove the experience farther and farther away from our experience, which is exactly the opposite of what we should be trying to do. We should make the experience of Jesus and of Krishna and of every great soul there ever was, we should make it completely accessible and comprehensible to us. We should be able to have been there and to have lived with them, and to have felt it just as they felt it, because these great masters did actually incarnate in human bodies. I read something that Master said that was really so sweet, the way he put it. He said if God had incarnated, if an avatar was just an angel, we would just rail at God for not making us as perfect as that angel was made. So the avatar has to actually really be a person, a human being. And of course, the teaching of self-realization is literally that a soul becomes an avatar by walking exactly the path that we're walking. I mentioned to you in other contexts, but I love to contemplate this. It's not merely that Master can understand our experience out of compassion, but he's actually been in this vibration. I mean, been in this vibration as we are in this vibration, because his soul passed through every stage to reach liberation. And we have unique circumstances. Maybe he didn't live on Earth in early Dwapara in Silicon Valley, you know, as a single mom or something like that. Because, I don't know, maybe he did. Sometimes you get really confused about how much you have to do before you're liberated. But if you think of it like this, is that everything that we're manifesting in our lives is a particular vibration. It's a vibration between complete delusion and absolute freedom. And the form that it takes is secondary to the vibration of consciousness. Does that make sense? That we vibrate at a certain level of consciousness, which is the sum total of our capacity to be divinely aware. And balanced by, or what creates that, is the degree to which we are unable to, which our hearts are still corroded, lack of purity of heart. I don't want to say the word impure because it sounds so terrible, but our hearts are still bound by likes and dislikes, by desires and resentments. And to that extent, they vibrate. And so when the purity of divine love wants to come in, there's a vibration that holds them at bay. But also there's a vibration that also welcomes the divine. And so the net total is, I mean, you could put a number on it. You could put an exact number on it, like a key on a piano. And from delusion to liberation, you have to ascend through all those vibrations until everything is purified. And Master did. And Jesus did. And Ananda Muyama did. And Swami Kriyananda did. They all went right through it. So their compassion for us is perfectly understandable. Just in the same way that when you sort of see someone who's struggling with the reality that you have been through and you understand how confusing it can be, there's a great deal of sympathy. You don't have to try hard to be sympathetic. You genuinely understand. You really understand what it's like to feel that way. Even if now you don't, you understand what it was. So the Masters have walked through all of this with us. I mean, that's the first part. And then what Master was saying is that, so the avatar is really a human being, and Master was talking about Jesus being tempted in the desert by Satan. And he said it wasn't play acting for him to send Satan away. And of course, when Master's talking about this, he's telling us about his experience. I mean, either as Jesus himself, which Swamiji asserts was a likelihood, or just as an avatar, because there is Master himself. He's writing this book, and he's describing his own experience. Or he's giving this talk, as it were. He's describing his own experience. What's it like to be fully liberated but living in a human body? He said, you feel the weakness of the flesh. That's how he put it. It doesn't mean you give in to it, or that you're bound by it, but you feel it. I mean, I was thinking last night, and I was talking about it a little bit. No matter how often people tell you that you're doing good work, that you're capable of what you're competent, you're a nice person, somebody really loves you, all of these different things. Nothing will persuade you to be at peace inside except to be at peace inside. And that's why I was reflecting on that last night. I don't know if I said it accurately or not. It's that one can be as famous and as lauded by everyone, and still you're only as free as you are. Nothing, absolutely nothing outside of you can penetrate and purify the anxiety of the heart except an actual change of consciousness, which is an actual receiving. And I've also been thinking a lot about that phrase of Jesus's, of John, to all who received him, to them gave he the power. And every time I read that, I think, what a no-brainer, just receive him. You know, like, like if that's the promise, why don't we all just do it? But it's a fascinating introspection to really try to receive that and watch how much resists. I shared that with you at first when I went on a seclusion, and it came to me, I had been sort of trying to give, you know, offer oneself into the light, and I just had this thought that maybe I should try to receive the light. But it was easier to offer it than it was to receive it. And, you know, I'm not neurotic like some people are. I'm quite happy to be taken care of. I don't have any problem. When I go to India and there's servants everywhere, that is no problem for me. Here's my laundry. You can give it back to me tonight. No issue. When is lunch? When is the driver coming? I'm really comfortable with that. I know some people are not. So it's not like that. But over the course of incarnations, and of course this one too, I've been hurt. I felt mistreated. I have past life memories of people who've mistreated me. I mean, past life intuitions is what I would say. I have deeply held feelings like everyone else. Nobody really understands me. What about me? No, we all go there. And in that seclusion, it was like they were like a bundle. It didn't really make any difference. The details really were so unimportant. But there was a bundle of self-centered pains and considerations. Justified, you should understand. But I was just holding them. Or they were just resting there. They were resting literally in my heart. That's what it is. Blessed are the pure in heart. Because the heart has been willing to relinquish all of those things and not keep that ego identification with those moments. I mean, what do you think happens when your heart gets broken? I mean, we talk about forgiving, but forgiving, and Swami often uses that word too, but he also speaks against it. You know, to forgive is like, to my mind, is not, I don't like it all that much, because if you're forgiving, then you're still holding the superior moral ground. You know, you've messed up, but I'm noble enough to say that it's okay that you messed up. That, to me, leaves an impression in my heart that I'm not fond of. To accept and forget, to realize there was nothing ever to forgive, that there was no self to be injured, that we're all just souls seeking liberation. I'm not saying that I can do all these things, I just find them more useful. Because what we end up with is we end up holding these feelings in our hearts, and even though we rail, we beat against the doors of heaven and beg God to come to us, he can't get in, because the divine is a vibration. It's a vibration of freedom, of perfect love, of perfect joy, and it tries to come into our heart and it gets a certain distance, and then there's no room. Just like a closet, you can only put so much in it, and we've got a lot of stuff stored there already. And when the divine tries to come in, it can get in some. And thank God, it does get in some. And that perks us all up and cheers us up and we go forward. And that's how the whole thing works itself out. That's how we get through this particular vibration. We get through it by allowing enough. We receive enough. And then we shift a little bit. We let go of little things. We find ourselves the mental tape shifts and certain things fall off and we don't hear them anymore. But then the others keep going. So that's what the masters are doing with us. They're trying to purify our hearts. And they're giving us the opportunities. They're giving us the experiences. They challenge us with circumstances. And we have to try to decide, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Last night I was talking about Peter pulled out his, when Jesus was being arrested, Peter pulled out his sword because he thought that was the right way to respond. And you can see it would be perfectly natural if somebody, you know, if people came in and tried to take Swami away from us, well, if people came in and tried to take Erica away from us, you know, we would struggle against it. We wouldn't all just sit here and just say, oh yeah, there's lots of people around, you can have her, you know, she's expendable. We would feel this tremendous desire to move against that force. We would see it as evil and we would want to stop it. Now, going back to Anandamayi Ma and Jesus, you know, Jesus was always and completely in charge. And his entourage of disciples and students and the apostles and all those, he was always doing something and taking a few with him and leaving a few behind. And it talks about how Jesus talked to the multitudes and then he took his disciples into seclusion and taught them differently. And when he was arranging the Last Supper, he didn't invite everyone. He was always moving, and then he was going here and he was going there. You read it in the Bible. So then he left, so then he came back in, so then he went to this place, and then he felt inspired to go there, and then they were off someplace, and they heard that Lazarus was ill, and Lazarus was the brother of Mary and Martha, the whole family was extremely dear to him, and all the disciples said, we must go. And Jesus said, no. And just again, put yourself in the situation. It's like everything says we should go. Didn't you hear? He's sick. We should go. Jesus says, no. And then everyone has to just fall back into their spine and move out of their mental ideas of how things should be and move with his energy. And then after a couple of days has passed, inexplicably for most of the disciples, he said, now let's go. And then they get to where Martha and Mary's house are, and Lazarus has been dead now for several days. And Martha hears he's coming and meets him on the road. My brother has died. He wouldn't have died if you had been here. Is this an accusation or a statement of faith? You know, the words can be read either way. Where were you? Or just, I know if it had been your will to be here, it could have been on either side. And then Mary is in the house meditating, and someone comes to her and says, the Lord is here. But they whisper it. That's also interesting. They whisper that God is here, rather than announcing to the whole room that God is here. There's little touches in this part. Jesus is very controversial. And the Bible tells us that Mary and Martha's house is not that far from Jerusalem. And so a lot of people know them. And a lot of people have come. Were all those people on the side of Jesus? Probably not. Because if they'd all been on the side of Jesus, then the message would have been, Jesus is here, everyone come. But in fact, the message is whispered to Mary. You know, the Lord is here. So Mary, who's been sitting in the house mourning, probably following the Jewish customs of mourning, she suddenly gets up and runs away. And other people think, oh, she's going to the tomb where Lazarus is buried. She's going to mourn by the tomb. And so in the Bible it says they, out of sympathy for her, they got up and followed her. Now, again, just be in the situation. You're sitting there with Mary. Mary suddenly gets up. Will you feel Jesus' presence? Will you sense that he's there? Will you be eager to see him? Will you be angry at him because he didn't come and save Lazarus? Do you believe that he could have saved Lazarus? Just, it's all very, very human, just like it would be if it were happening today. So they follow him, her. And because they follow her, then you have all these witnesses. And these are not sympathetic witnesses. That's what the Bible implies. And so then Lazarus, Jesus is standing there outside of Lazarus's tomb. This is a very important incident in the Bible because they describe this as a turning point in terms of the priests who were in power becoming more and more frightened about the influence of Jesus. Because this is all so verified. You know, and Jesus, see, this is Jesus' inner call. He didn't go and save Lazarus. He needed for Lazarus to die. He didn't calculate it. He didn't say, well, I need for somebody to die. How about Lazarus? And this is, again, where reading about Ananda Mahima and myself watching Swamiji a great deal of the time. I'll just take a little piece out of this. What I watched with Swamiji, what I gradually began to figure out, I mean, if you sat and calculated, well, I'll treat this one that way, and then this one will respond like this, and then I'll be able to do that for this one, it would all be so power-oriented. And there are so-called teachers who behave in that way. They calculate. But Swamiji, like any true great lover of God, he just responded. Just like Ananda Mahima, he wasn't quite as incomprehensible as much of the time, but he was often incomprehensible. He just responded to whatever inner prompting he felt. And he had complete faith that if he followed that inner prompting, whatever was needed would happen next. And if it all unfolded in a beautifully orchestrated way, he was not surprised, because he knew it would, but he did not know what it would do always. He just knew that if he followed step by step, then whatever was needed next would come. Now, of course, that is the sadhana, actually. That is the sadhana, is to be able to be in tune and know what you're supposed to do. I was talking about that last night. You don't always know where it's going. And even the masters don't always know where it's going. Although, as Swami said, they've seen the movie before, but they don't concentrate on the fact that they know the plot. They just let it play out the way it's supposed to play out. So Jesus asked them to roll the rock aside. And Martha protested. He's been in there for 4 days. His dead body's been in there for 4 days. It's not going to be pretty. And Jesus insisted. So there they all are. It's like all of a sudden they're opening the tomb. Like, how strange is that? And who would be able to just feel the flow of Jesus' energy and just go with it? And whose minds were going to be chattering away, what could he possibly be doing? What a wacky thing for him to do. If he cared about this man, why didn't he come 4 days ago? Or just that having that, purity of heart. To just match your vibration to Jesus's, and wherever he's going, you're just going to go with him. Which some of his disciples could do. John and others are notable for that. So Jesus rolls back the tomb, and then in a loud voice, he calls the name of Lazarus. And Lazarus comes walking out. They never, unfortunately, in the Bible, interview Lazarus, which I'm sure they did. It just didn't make it into the gospel. I mean, of course, I mean, they must have asked him so many questions. What did it feel like? Where were you? It must have been a whole story about the astral world and what it must have felt like. Master brought people back from death several times, and one woman said she was just far, far away, is how she described it. And then she heard this voice calling her. And the voice was insistent enough that she came back. But she was far, far away. So where was Lazarus? Because he was really dead. He just comes walking out, wrapped up in all the stuff that he was wrapped up in. And again, can you imagine the gasp? I mean, even the terror that came into people. Who is this man? How could he possibly do this? And you're standing there. Which way is your heart going to go? Is your heart going to immediately go that, you know, this is the Christ, this is the Messiah? Only the Son of God could do this. Or is your first thought going to be that he's a magician? He's in league with the devil. And some did feel that way. Some just thought, this is so beyond what is acceptable. I mean, it's so funny. You would think, well, gee, this is like being able to raise the dead. You wouldn't just naturally be enthusiastic about it. But it's socially inconvenient. And it was to have someone who could move like that.
What caused Lazarus to die in the first place?
They don't tell you. He was ill. He was just ill. My brother is ill, ill unto death, which indeed he was. So then they all decide that the power people, this is in the Bible, all decide that they really have to get rid of Jesus because this is too much. Because this is witnessed by people who had no reason to believe, and it is so impossible to deny. And then they say in the Bible, we're not only going to have to kill Jesus, we're going to have to kill Lazarus too. Yeah, because as long as Lazarus is walking around, and implied there, which is not drawn out, is that Lazarus was testifying that he was indeed truly dead and that he was somewhere and that Jesus came and got him. I mean, you have to fill it in, but imagine what that story is. Because human beings are human beings. You think when you didn't get Lazarus by himself, you were going to ask him questions? Of course you're going to ask him questions. And everybody's going to be talking to everybody. And I talked to Lazarus and he said that he was in the darkness and Jesus came walking across a cloud and took him by the hand. And I mean, who knows what the story was, but there's got to be a story. Yeah, go ahead.
It's hard to understand, just listening, why anyone would be mad at Jesus or even scared of Jesus. But then when you think of as more modern times, not much more modern, but Father Cupertino and Padre Pio, who were treated by superiors in just the same way because of whatever that emotion is in response to the special times.
I've worked really hard to get my position in this temple. You know, my father had to pay off a lot of people. I've disciplined myself to be here this whole time. Sorry. Let me get this clear.
He's got special power.
I have this lavish house on the main street, and my children are in private school. And I'm just about to arrange a marriage with my son to, you know, my buddy in the power structure myself. And this man is going to topple the whole thing. I have no purity of heart or lack of it. When the power of the divine starts coming in, what does it meet? It meets attachment to fame. It meets attachment to power. It meets attachment to position. It meets fear of the unknown. It meets, I know this is true because everyone else says it's true and he's the only one who asserts something differently. And just there's a thousand things. And yeah, maybe Lazarus was dead, but maybe it was just Martha and Mary who just conspired to make this happen. I heard of an incident over in Galilee where they did just that. You know, those Galileans can't be trusted, you know. And they also had the concept of magic, which was different than the Messiah. You know, maybe he's a magician rather than a saint. But there's a thousand reasons why people do not want change, and less do they want transformation. And, you know, reason follows feeling. So the feeling is this is a huge threat to the status quo. And many people just don't like anything that isn't tidy. Most people's opinions are based on what is going on around them. And Jesus did not fit. He was just so radical. I mean, we're a little radical ourselves, but already we have this beautiful church, and you can sort of walk into this church and you have the feeling that something is actually going on here. I'm not saying it in any way that matters, but when Swami was first just wandering around by himself, just teaching classes at the YMCA, and suggesting that people come up to this barren wilderness where he was going to build a community and leave all their security and everything behind. Well, in Pune, India, where you were, leave your family, upset your mother, disrupt her plans for your marriage, and just come and do what Swami Kriyananda says? Like, are you kidding? Why would I do that? It didn't rise to the level of Swami needing to be crucified. It did in the U.S., but not death, but crucifixion by reputation, by destruction of reputation, to try to, he was perceived as a threat. I mean, there you have it, actually, because the SRF Ananda is more analogous to the Sanhedrin trying to get rid of Jesus because they had their established ways and he threatened it. And SRF had its established ways and Swami threatens it. He threatens it on a very fundamental level, so they did their very best to expunge him. And they failed. They succeeded in creating distrust and darkness, but they did not really succeed in wiping him out. But they caused a heck of a lot of trouble, which continues. But it's exactly analogous. It wasn't it wasn't President Obama who cared about what Ananda was doing, because President Obama doesn't even know we're here, and he doesn't recognize the potential power. So even the Romans, you see, didn't really care what Jesus was doing. He wasn't bothering them. That's why Pilate, when it came down to it, said, What's the problem here? I don't see any problem. And they said, it's a problem for us because he's manifesting power. See, also, the fight was the law of Moses. The law of Moses said that these things all have to be done, and when you follow these laws, then you are pleasing in the eyes of God. And who's going to explain these laws to you? Well, we will. And who's going to decide whether you've done them properly? Well, we're going to tell you that. And all of these other things are involved that involved money and power and oppression and keeping the people in line. And it was all very much in place. And Jesus went to the temple, and all the money changers that he threw out, all of that was about the necessity to make certain sacrifices, to purchase what you needed to make those sacrifices, and only they could only be purchased from certain people and only certain authorized people, and only certain kinds of money could be offered, and that money had to be, your money had to be exchanged for the temple money. And all of that was going on, and all of that was the way in which the people in charge, who, as Jesus described, walked around in fancy clothes and with trumpets in front of them so everyone would know, here come the leaders of the temple. And Jesus just came in and he disrupted all of it. He disregarded the laws. He did not follow all of the strictures. He didn't, you know, eat the right foods necessarily or wash his hands in the right way. He healed on the Sabbath. See, the interesting things about all these disputes is they're so obscure to us. We can't figure out what the heck is really going on here. And so we try to draw subtle analogies, but it wasn't subtle at all. It was, this is the way you were a Jew. And this is the only way you could be a Jew. And he said, no, actually, you see, your day is over. I am the fulfillment of the prophecy that the Messiah was going to come and that the Messiah would bring in a new era. I mean, so again, you look on the other side, think of the courage of the disciples in the face of all of that to go with him and to disregard the rules that were set up, you know, when they were even being told that it was at their peril, that they would, you know, they would perish eternally. They would be damned forever if they broke those laws, and they felt enough power in Jesus to follow him. Now, there's a whole other secondary set of stories, which is that the Essene community within the Jewish community was a small sect that essentially was true to the true teachings of Judaism, which is Sanatan Dharma, and that they were already separated from the corruption of their own faith, and that Jesus came, was an Essene, came to that community, and that community altogether was already courageously ready to carry out this revolution. So that many of them were not subject. So what was big in the Bible was every time they'd get somebody from the existing power structure and pull them in. When one of the Pharisees or one of the other temple guards or the tax collectors, all these people, because they were beginning then to widen their circle and pull them in. But everybody knew that there would be a final confrontation because what was going on was impossible. It could not be sustained. And the whole story of Judas is that Judas thought the best way to deal with this is to cultivate these people. After all, I mean, I'm not going to say it's analogous, but everyone tells me that what we need to do is we need to get on Oprah. And great, I would be fine. You know, let's get one of us on Oprah. Let's get Finding Happiness. But every time I hear it, part of me just thinks, oh, you know, let's see who's in power and let's get the people in power to endorse us. Let's find a celebrity. One of the first ideas for the Finding Happiness movie is that we would find a famous person. We would get a famous person. And the whole story that ended up being the actress, Juliet, going to Ananda and so on. Well, we would get a famous person to do that. And we would do it like a documentary. And that famous person would discover. And that famous person would probably be a beautiful Hollywood actress. I was so averse to the whole idea of it. I could hardly be in the conversation. I just had to seal my lips because I knew I was reacting. Just to the idea of getting some, let's pretend we got somebody really noble, but some person who's famous for being famous to endorse Swami Kriyananda just embarrassed me. You know, it's like, I mean, I'm perfectly happy. Many famous people are lovely, so it's not like it's inherent, but the whole idea of it just, I found it so aversive, I couldn't even be in the conversations. It was a good sadhana for me. Oh, yeah, that's an idea. I learned to say, wow, that's an idea. But just a moment. So that's also a temptation that we have to think about. Yeah, that is the story of Judas, as Master tells it. The story of Judas was, he just thought they're never going to get the show on the road as long as Jesus kept consorting with these low-class people. They imply, and Master talks about it, you know, that Jesus was of a different class. Judas was of a different class. And he was very magnetic, and he had the power to sort of be on both sides of it. And he just really wanted to take Jesus to another level. And the story behind his betrayal is that he was going to force the issue. Instead of being surrendered to the inner intuition of Jesus as to how this should unfold, he decided that he would force the issue. And so he would instigate the arrest of Jesus because he thought that would bring about that Jesus would, he was going to force Jesus to reveal himself. And that's why immediately after Jesus was crucified, Judas killed himself. Because that it did not end the way he expected it to end. He was orchestrating a great event. And he failed miserably because he was acting from what Jesus had gone a certain distance into his heart, and then what was met there was pride, attachment to money, attachment to fame, attachment to position. And the earlier leading up to that is when Jesus is sitting in the with his disciples, and Mary Magdalene comes in. And now in that society, the men and the women sat separately. You know, the men would be in one room, the women would be in another. Jesus did had men and women disciples. And somebody was quoting to me from the Gospel of Thomas, which I haven't read, which was, you know, one of those uncovered books that isn't in the four Gospels, that Jesus said to the men disciples that he made Mary Magdalene a man. She's a man, and you must treat her like one now. Meaning, he made her equal. And I don't know whether that's true or not. That sounds But the point being, she was his devoted disciple, and the fact that she was female had nothing to do with it. But in the context of the society, it had a lot to do with it. But mainly, she was just an over-the-top devotee who didn't have much sense of propriety. If, in fact, she was, as it's described, a courtesan, the most accurate descriptions I've heard of her from various sources were that she was a high-class woman, but she was a different kind of woman. She became a courtesan, but not like a street prostitute, but just a... And she had her own money and her own land, and she was a very powerful person, that she wasn't just some prostitute that came up off the street. But because of that, she was totally outside the social norm. She had long since stopped caring what anybody thought and just moved according to her own reality, and was the first to see Jesus resurrected, and stayed with him at the cross. She had many fine qualities, but so there they are having dinner. So Mary Magdalene just comes in, and she must have sensed something, you see, even though Jesus was telling them that the time was near. Most people didn't seem to know that. But on some level, she must have, because of the way Jesus responded to her. So she breaks into the dinner party. Again, just think about it. So we're all, you know, out on the patio here, and Swami's with us, as he was several times. And we're all having a nice meal together, and then suddenly some woman comes in. She goes straight to Swamiji. She kneels at his feet. She washes his feet. She has this urn of extremely costly scent, perfume of some kind, which she breaks over his feet, and then she takes her hair and she washes his feet with her hair. I mean, you're sitting there. Everybody else is having dinner, and she's on the floor doing this. And, I mean, with her hair. Just imagine, again, how would you respond? Would you be able to just go with that flow? Would you notice, as Jesus did, that Jesus just accepted it without demur, that there was nothing in him that in any way chastised her? And then Judas is the one who becomes, I mean, everybody, I'm sure, is a little uncomfortable, but Mary Magdalene doesn't care. There's only one reality in the room to her, and that's Jesus. She doesn't care what anybody thinks. She probably doesn't even know they're there, and certainly thinks they're beneath notice. Why would she care? She has this relationship with Jesus, and she's going to do what she knows he wants from her. Because when Judas criticizes her for the extravagance, I mean, everything about it was probably just extremely distressing to him, not the least of which that she was a woman and he was a man, and how does this look, and she has a bad reputation and all of that. And then he plays the card of economy. This was a waste of money, he says. I mean, just take the whole thing. And then he tries to argue that this was a waste of money. Why, that money could have been used for something else, and now it's all been spent on your feet by this extravagant woman. It could have been used to help the poor. So then Jesus hints, the poor you have always with me, I will not always be with you. And he's telling them 1,000 things in that moment. How many people were able to hear it? How many people knew what was really being said? And he says also, she was saving this against the hour of my death. So he's implying also that his death is close. If she was going to use it on me after I die, why not use it on me while I'm still here? And you can just, because I've seen Swamiji so many times, you can just imagine that what was going on between Mary Magdalene and Christ. Just as a disciple, imagine the... what I can only think of how much he approved of her courage and the intensity of her devotion. There's an interesting story that Swami tells about in the ashram at Mount Washington, that one of the monks became extremely extravagant in his emotional outpouring during one of their meditations. He was rolling on the ground and he was crying and pleading with God to come to him, and most of the monks found it offensive. And they went to Master and said, you know, he was doing these things. And Master said, that's how you should behave. You should want God more than you want anything else. Now, of course, later he said to the monk, if you hold some of these feelings inside, they will get deeper. But he also was telling the others, you know, why don't you all be a little more like him? Give a little more. So it's always they're playing all of this. But Mary was too in tune with Jesus. She would not have come and done that if he hadn't called her to. Would any of us have had the nerve to? If we'd felt called like that, would we have been able to carry it through? This is where you ask your heart, how much of the vibration can I receive? You know, how much can I just hear what's asked of me and do it and not stop and think? So for Judas, it was just the last. And then the Bible, again, it just hints. Judas kept the purse. Judas kept all the money for everyone, for the whole work. So, I mean, that's a position of enormous trust and also a position of enormous competency. But the Bible also says that Judas used that money as he wanted to for his own purposes. He was stealing from it, too. So it was pure hypocrisy to be worried about that. He just, it was too much for him, all of it. And he decided to take matters into his own hands. Swami writes in his chapter on attunement about how tempting it is sometimes to think, well, you know, Jesus was, after all, a great soul, but he doesn't know much about marketing. He doesn't really understand how society works. We need somebody famous to endorse Swami Kriyananda. We need somebody like, I don't know who, I wasn't going to say names, but we need somebody famous to tell everyone that he's a worthwhile man. It's comical on the face of it, but you see how easily we fall into it? And how... what an adventure. It's wonderful to have these done deals. You know, like the life of Christ is a done deal.
But being in the middle
of it. Yeah, because then we can walk our way through it and then make the analogy of what's happening to us. I mean, when we were... persecuted by Self-Realization Fellowship, and when the tremendous effort was made to destroy Swami Kriyananda's reputation, it was a really serious issue. Now it's like a grand adventure, but when it was happening, it was, where is this going? You know, where is this really going? What's happening here? What is the truth of this situation? And I was really amused. Most of the people, not all, but most of the people at Ananda did not have a close relationship with Self-Realization Fellowship before they joined Ananda. Most had no particular relationship with Dhyamata and very little actual knowledge of her. Swami Kriyananda, especially in his book, The Path, paints a beautiful picture of Dhyamata and her devotion to Master and what a great disciple she was. And he even, in his book, talks himself about how he wanted to model himself after her. And then she's the one spearheading the attack on Swamiji, trying to prove that he's an unworthy disciple. And then, because people have short memories, they would talk about, well, Dhyamata's a great disciple, how could she be wrong? And I would know for a fact that their opinion of Dhyamata had been formed by what Swami wrote in The Path. And so I said to Swamiji at one point, I think I put this into my book about Swami, Swami, when you wrote The Path, you were already deeply persecuted by Daya. You knew she had another side to her. He said, yes. I said, you knew you were setting yourself up, weren't you? He said, yes. He said, but everything I wrote in the book is also true. And so truth demanded it. That was the true story, and it was true. And I said, so now you're reaping what you sowed, aren't you? Yes, he said. But just with that, just complete, you just do what God wants, and you just, if you're dharmic in every moment, it will just take its course. And it's not yet over, you know, what that was, what all that persecution was about, because the confusion of it still It's a shadow way at the edge, but it's still a shadow way at the edge. And so I don't think the end of that story is in yet. I'm not sure what the end of that story is. We'll just have to wait and see. But again, here we are. I mean, our story doesn't feel like the story of Jesus because it's not in the Bible and it's not a done deal. So we don't actually really know. I mean, Master's life was not the unsullied triumph that is put forward. He had many, many, many obstacles. Many people attacked him and denigrated him and did not accept him. So we have to constantly ask ourselves, am I a fair-weather disciple? What is the basis of my commitment? Is that because it's easy and nothing challenges it? Or if everything challenged it, what do I feel and why do I feel it? And during that time when we were being attacked, it was really interesting because you got to ask yourself, well, why do I think these things are true? What is the basis of it? And what would happen if somebody challenged me? Well, I think we should have a chant and a brief meditation, and we can reflect inwardly on all of those.